somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 30, Northern Lights, the Scandinavian Breakthrough. The problem of creating modern political institutions has been described as the problem of getting to Denmark. So writes the famous American political scientist Francis Fukuyama in his book, The Origins of Political Order. And Fukuyama goes on. For people in developed countries, Denmark is a mythical place that is known to have good political and economic institutions. It is stable, democratic, peaceful, prosperous, inclusive, and has extremely low levels of political corruption. Much the same could be said of Denmark's Scandinavian siblings, Sweden and Norway. But that a prominent American intellectual should laud Denmark as the epitome of democracy, freedom and the rule of law is quite ironic. Because as historian Bernard Balin has shown, to the American founding generation, Scandinavia was the seat of absolute and arbitrary government and religious tyranny. To them, it was common knowledge that Sweden and Denmark have sold or betrayed their liberties. Denmark in particular was singled out as the archetype of despotic absolutism, which stood in sharp contrast to the checks and balances securing the supreme value of freedom, which the founders hailed constantly and on repeat in colonial-era pamphlets and newspapers. The founders had learned about Denmark's sad fate from the English Whig Robert Molesworth's 1694 An Account of Denmark, which was widely read in the colonies. Molesworth had been the English ambassador to Denmark, and boy did he hate the place. The Danes were uneducated, uncultured, and enslaved by a conspiracy of a monarchy that was absolute and arbitrary, not the least remnant of liberty remaining to the subject, and, on the other hand, bigoted priests who ensured that all were of one mind. There were few books available, and those published were just religious propaganda. To Molesworth, it had been a mistake to think that Catholicism, or popery, as was the standard derogatory term used by Whigs, was the only Christian sect apt to induce slavery in a nation. Denmark was proof that
it is not popery as such, but the doctrine of a blind obedience in what religion soever it be found, that is the destruction of the liberty and consequently of the happiness of any nation.
To the founders, Sweden was another case of freedom lost, writes Balin.
The colonists themselves could remember when the Swedish people had enjoyed liberty to the full, but now they were known to rejoice at being subject to the caprice and arbitrary power of a tyrant and kiss their chains.
The English freethinker and deist Matthew Tindal, whom we met in episode 21, copy-pasted and shared Molesworth's Scandinavia's despotism meme. And as late as 1776, Tom Paine used Denmark and Sweden as Exhibit A in his indictment against the incorrigible evils and obstinacy of absolute monarchy in his revolutionary blockbuster pamphlet, Common Sense. As we shall see, the founders' picture of Denmark and Sweden was both outdated and one-sided. But there were certainly important elements of truth in these dramatized and self-congratulatory Whiggish accounts of despotic Scandinavia. Both Denmark and Sweden had a long tradition of Lutheran orthodoxy, had experienced absolutism, and emphasized centralized monarchical rule and religious unity, enforced by heavy-handed censorship of both religious writings and meetings. And since state and religion was joined at the hip, censorship of religion was difficult to separate from censorship of political ideas, which meant that high treason, blasphemy, and heresy were liable to be conflated. Criticize the king, and you commit a crime against religion, criticize religion, and you commit a crime against the king. Since 1660, Denmark had become Europe's premier absolutist state, with its King's Law Constitution of 1665 and the comprehensive Danish law from 1683. But as we shall see, Sweden had actually embarked on an early adventure of parliamentarism in 1790 with its so-called Age of Liberty. But this liberty did not provide the citizens with individual rights, nor abolish censorship, which remained firm and systematic for much of this period. So it's safe to say that few 18th century Enlightenment thinkers would have hazarded to guess that Sweden and Denmark would be the first states in the world to adopt constitutional protections of free speech and abolish all censorship, respectively. Yes, my American listeners, you heard that right. George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights, with its guarantee that the freedom of the press is one of the great bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments, was beaten to it by the descendants of Vikings in the kingdoms of Sweden and Denmark-Norway. Sweden was also more than two decades, and Denmark-Norway more than 15 years ahead of Article 11 of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man from 1789, and the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution as ratified in 1791. But the Northern Lights were fleeting, and after burning brightly for a few years, were almost extinguished until finding new oxygen only in the 19th century. Sweden's first written instrument of government was issued in 1634. It stressed that religious unity was the basis of all lawful and lasting government. Hence, the king, civil servants, and all Swedish subjects had to accept God's pure and clear word, as explained in the Augsburg Confession, the body of articles of faith of Lutheran Protestantism. In order to ensure that no one was enticed away from the pure faith, a meticulous censorship regime was created in the 1660s and 80s. Any and all writings had to be submitted to pre-publication censorship. In 1684, a special censor was appointed to combat religious unorthodoxy, which also included compiling an index of prohibited foreign books that could not be imported into the realm. An index from 1708 includes 78 prohibited titles. Literary control with the university was also beefed up, and in 1687, a prohibition on publishing the already closely guarded proceedings of the organs of state was issued. Foreigners were subject to the control of the Lutheran Church in order to protect against unorthodox ideas, and the importation of books that deviated from Lutheranism was strictly prohibited. In other words, religious and political censorship was extremely forbidding in 17th century Sweden. I should say, at this point, and until 1809, Finland formed part of the Kingdom of Sweden. And as we'll see, Swedes from what is now Finland played a prominent role in overturning Swedish censorship. But the reason Sweden broke entirely new ground in terms of protecting freedom of speech and access to information owed a lot to specific historical and political circumstances that led Sweden to discard absolutism. When the warrior king Charles XII died in 1718, Swedish political culture changed dramatically. The Diet, or parliament, gained the upper hand at the expense of the king. The Diet was made up of four estates: the nobility, the clergy, the burghers, and the peasantry. The representatives of the three non-noble estates were elected, and in the Diet, each estate had one vote. Around 60% of the male population had a direct or indirect vote in elections for these states. And according to historian Jonas Nordin, this made Sweden by far the most widely participatory political system anywhere in Europe. These states were dominated by two political parties, the Hats and the Caps. And no, I'm not making those names up. The king remained mostly a figurehead, while executive power was vested in the Council of the Realm, answerable to the Diet. It is this period of Swedish history which is known as the Age of Liberty. but it was collective political freedom from absolute monarchy, not individual freedom to think, speak, and write as you wish. Sure, most Swedes, at least most male Swedes, could vote for members of the different estates. But that's where their influence and control ended. Voters had no way of finding out how their representatives actually voted, and they certainly couldn't write an op-ed in the local newspaper if they thought the government or the representatives were useless, corrupt, and ignorant, which, it turned out, a lot of them were. Because by law, it was forbidden to share or publicize the minutes of Diet proceedings. And even within the Diet, there was a special committee where confidential matters were discussed and which excluded the fourth estate of peasants. This was not exactly unusual. Across Europe, the ancient principle of arcana imperii widely prohibited the public's access to the records of state organs. And we've seen that publishing minutes of both parliament in England and assemblies in colonial America being punished. But if you thought, hey, I really like having a vote and all, but I'd like to know why and who voted in favor of increasing the tax on herring, you couldn't just criticize the constitutional system. Because all writings were subject to pre-publication censorship by the censor liborum, a learned civil servant who screened manuscripts for anything offensive or indecent before graciously stamping publications with imprimatur, the official stamp of approval. He also supervised the importation of foreign books. Religious writings had to run the gauntlet of initial vetting by ecclesiastical authorities as well as the prying eyes of the censor. Academic institutions had their own censorship mechanisms as well. This meant that there was no real public political debate in print, though handwritten manuscripts were shared in closed circuits. No daily newspaper existed until the 1760s. Which must sound like heaven for modern politicians, inundated by around-the-clock criticism and questions on social media, blogs, newspapers, TV, radio, email, and whatnot. But from around the 1750s, educational reforms and enlightenment and natural law ideas had worked long enough on the minds of many leading Swedes that attitudes started changing. In 1755, the first political magazine, An Honest Swede, Now, no sniggering Danes and Norwegians, was published. It probably didn't hurt that the editor of An Honest Swede also happened to be the official censor, Niklas von Olrich, or that the Honest Swede was the mouthpiece of the hat party to which conveniently Olrich belonged. When the Caps wanted a rival propaganda magazine, Olrich nixed it. But von Olrich was no Roger Lestrange, the notorious English censor we met in episode 15. In fact, the following years would see Ulrich in conflict with his bosses in the government's chancery board, who supervised his work and thought that Ulrich was becoming soft and permissive. In 1750, the chancery board had outright banned any discussion of government affairs to stem the tide of new ideas bubbling under the surface. In 1759, things came to a head when the Finnish-born natural scientist, orientalist, and philosopher Peter Forsskål published his Thoughts on Civil Liberty with the imprimatur of Ulrich. Forsskål was inspired by David Hume and empiricism. He also championed the idea of every human's natural right to live a life in freedom. Forsskål twice had his manuscript rejected by university censors and the Chancery Board. But he then approached Ulrich directly, insisting that he, who lived in the land of freedom, must surely be allowed the most tender part of freedom to speak and write about the flaws and benefits of the country. Ulrich actually agreed, though he did require some changes that moderated the pamphlet's radical message of limited government and freedom of political and religious speech. In the original pamphlet, Forsskål wrote, "The life and strength of civil liberty consist in limited government and unlimited freedom of the written word, as long as serious punishment follows all writings, which is indisputably indecent, contains blasphemy against God, insults private individuals, and incites apparent vices." Forsskål also wrote, "Divine revelations, wise fundamental laws, and the honor of private individuals cannot suffer any dangerous damage by such freedom of expression.
because truth always wins when it is allowed to be denied and defended equally.
This passage was deleted in its entirety by Ulrich. To Forskål, freedom of the written word develops knowledge most highly, removes all harmful statutes, restrains the injustices of all officials, and is the government's surest defense in a free state. And then he wrote something risky, which a paranoid regime might have interpreted as a threat. A wise government would rather let its subjects express their displeasure with pens than with other weapons. Forskål also pointed to Pennsylvania as proof that differences between religions may exist without disturbing civil unity. Although the reference to Pennsylvania didn't survive Ulrich's red pen. You can actually see a scanned document with all Ulrich's changes to the initial draft online, and I've provided a link at freespeechhistory.com. But even with Ulrich's many changes, the Chancery Board was less than happy with Forskål's work and ordered it confiscated. But Forskål was constantly one step ahead. He had already picked up and distributed some 500 copies from the printer. In 1760, thoughts on civil liberty was formally banned and possession was punished with crippling fines. But as Barbara Streisand could have told the Swedish government, that only increased the popularity of the work. Forskål himself was let off with a warning, but died in Yemen in 1763 as part of the Danish Niebuhr expedition to Arabia. But Forskål's refusal to take no for an answer demonstrated the weakness of the Swedish censorship regime. It relied on self-censorship and an acceptance of the authority of the censor. It was not a system constructed to deal with stubborn radicals. Ulrich's lax censorship also led out another explosive work in 1759, that of Anders Nordenkrantz, a newly elected member of the Diet for the Cap Party, who wrote a stinging attack on the hats and the deficiencies of the current government and political system. Nordenkrantz claimed that the lack of press freedom and access to information encouraged corruption and mismanagement due to the lack of public accountability. The government moved to suppress distribution of the work, but when the Diet met in 1760, the work was released and distributed in 1,000 copies. Nordenkrantz's ideas would influence a proposal for a Press Freedom Act in 1761 to 1762. Though despite deep unpopularity, the Hats still managed to cling on to power and used their influence to stall the bill in committee, from where it never materialized, though it was agreed to revisit the question in the next session. But in 1765, the Hats were trounced in Diet elections, ending their 25 years of domination. The estate saw an influx of Cap representatives who were from more modest backgrounds but held more radical political views. And now the momentum for press freedom had grown so strong that it couldn't be stifled. Getting from a motion to an actual Press Freedom Act was a Byzantine process that required skillful politicking and some very close votes in committee. I won't bore you with the details. But the most influential proponent of press freedom was Anders Chydenius, a priest and prolific writer on economics born in Finland. He wrote the report of the committee responsible for the Press Freedom Act, in which he first outlined the arguments against abolishing censorship and then systematically dismantled them. You can read the entire report in English if you follow the link from freespeechhistory.com. Chydenius pointed out that
scarcely any work can be so carefully worded that it cannot be said to give rise to some offense or other against the system of government, or to point to individuals and thus be labeled as subversive, not useful, and dangerous.
And
no law can be formulated so clearly that it may not in 100 ways be distorted and misinterpreted when it is in the hands of a prosecutor who is also the judge in the case.
Some degree of arbitrariness was an inherent feature in all laws, but since press freedom was the most precious jewel of liberty, better to eliminate this dangerous risk altogether. True to jubilant Enlightenment optimism, though more questionable from a modern empirical point of view, Chydenius wrote,
truths exercise a persuasive power over the human heart if they are simply allowed to irradiate it freely and without constraint. But obscurantism and prejudices leave it unmoved.
Very cleverly, the report then claimed to have asserted that the crippling economic crisis was principally due to obscurantism and secrecy, and that it was an incontrovertible truth that had printing been free, those evils could never have occurred that have reduced our country to insolvency. In one fell swoop, Chydenius managed to lay the blame of Sweden's crisis on the policies of the Hats, as well as accusing them for having used secrecy and censorship to cover up their dirty deeds. These arguments had completely persuaded the committee of the harmfulness of regular censorship in a free nation. The committee thus recommended that censorship of the office of censor being useless, unnecessary and harmful should henceforward cease entirely. Chydenius' report concluded with this ringing endorsement of press freedom.
The freedom of the nation is always proportional to the freedom of printing it possesses, so that neither can exist without the other. To the extent that a nation is free, its freedom of printing will be the same, but on the contrary, where printing is muzzled by some form of guardianship, it is an infallible sign that the nation is fettered.
The report persuaded the Diet of the need to protect press freedom and freedom of information. Although compromises had to be made before the clergy was on board, and His Majesty's gracious ordinance relating to freedom of writing and of the press could finally be adopted on December 2, 1766. The foreword stressed
the great advantages that flow to the public from a lawful freedom of writing and of the press,
and that
an unrestricted mutual enlightenment in various useful subjects not only promotes development and dissemination of sciences and useful crafts, but also offers greater opportunities to each of our loyal subjects to gain improved knowledge and appreciation of a wisely ordered system of government.
Interestingly, it also points to press freedom and freedom of information as one of the best means of improving morality and promoting obedience to the laws when abuses and illegalities are revealed to the public through the press. So why is it that the Swedish Press Freedom Act is regarded as unique and the first of its kind in the world? After all, I've been going on about how the Dutch Republic and England were the most liberal states in the late 17th and 18th centuries. But neither the Dutch Republic nor England had adopted specific laws that positively protected freedom of speech. The tolerance of political and religious ideas that were censored or punished elsewhere rested on a more liberal political culture, as well as factors that hindered one political or religious group in exerting total dominance over others. But in principle, no fundamental law prohibited Dutch provinces or the English Parliament from limiting freedom of expression, as in fact happened on several occasions, as we have seen. Parliament in England also came close to reintroducing pre-publication licensing after the Licensing Act had lapsed in 1695, and no legal principle could have stopped them. I'm vaguely aware that the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth had codified a certain protection of oral free speech as early as 1609 and again in 1775 and 1791. But since the earliest of these protections applied only to the nobility and not everyone, they hardly qualify, even though they certainly deserve a more thorough treatment in this podcast series. The Swedish Act, on the other hand, was constitutional in nature. It stated,
"May the unfailing existence of the freedom to write and freedom of printing that has been determined possess the absolute assurance that an irrevocable constitutional law entails."
Crucially, it was based on the principle that only those topics specifically exempted in the Act could be punished. Everything else was left free to write about. Such a firm protection of free speech was not known anywhere else at the time. But as always, we need to qualify the extent of actual freedom of speech guaranteed by the Swedish Press Freedom Act. There were significant carve-outs. Challenges to the evangelical faith, attacks on the constitution, the royal family or foreign powers, defamatory remarks about civil servants or fellow citizens, and indecent or obscene literature were not protected. In fact, the clergy had managed to retain specific pre-publication censorship of all theological writings, a pretty big deal in those days, which showed that Lutheran orthodoxy had not yet run its course. Oh, and the foreign book trade was still subject to control. My favorite example of post-1766 censorship was when the government moved to suppress a newspaper piece on the problems of the herring fishery, which threatened foreign exports. Don't mess with Scandinavians and their herring. Though if you had tasted fried herring marinated in vinegar, you might actually sympathize with the government. Arguably, the constitutional protection of press freedom was not the most groundbreaking feature of the Press Freedom Act, given that in practice, other states already allowed more controversial writings than those now protected by law in Sweden. The truly groundbreaking feature of the Act was that it also protected freedom of information, and extensively so. All documents and minutes from the courts, public authorities, Diet, and even the government were now accessible to the public. Even negotiations with foreign powers required specific justifications to be exempted from the public eye. Drafts from ongoing deliberations in the Diet were, however, off limits. But ordinary Swedes, who previously had been in the dark about what was being said and written by their representatives, could now show up and demand access to and buy as many copies of official documents as they could afford, without having to provide any reason. All they needed was to pay the cost price. No other European country had so systematically demolished the ancient principle of arcana imperii. As we've seen in England, Austria, and as we'll also see in Denmark, the abolishment of censorship saw an explosion in Swedish print publications. According to historian Marie Christine Skunke, a measly 70 periodicals were published in 46 years between 1720 and 66. But in less than a decade, 100 such publications appeared between 1767 and 1774. The 8 years from 1766 to 74 also accounts for 75% of the political pamphlets published between 1700 and 1809. And between 1769 and 72, an average of 434 pamphlets were published a year. The second half of the 18th century also shows a huge increase in book consumption and literacy in Sweden, far surpassing that of Denmark. But just as freedom of the press and information had become features of the Age of Liberty, the young King Gustav III launched a bloodless coup d'etat in 1772. Which rolled back the reforms of the previous 50 years of parliamentary rule, including the Press Freedom Act. In 1774, the king issued a new Press Freedom Act. A master of propaganda and PR, the king planned to enroll the stamp of approval of Voltaire by sending him a copy. But in reality, the 1774 Press Freedom Act was much more restrictive than the original one from 1766, with much tougher punishments and joint liability for printers, which incentivized them to censor the authors whose books they published. Then, in 1792, Gustav III was assassinated by disgruntled nobles during a masquerade ball at the Royal Opera. And after a short glimmer of hope for press freedom, a period with much more autocratic controls over writings and information began, lasting until 1809. Fittingly, this period of Swedish history is known as the Iron Years. It is sometimes said that no nations have fought more wars than Denmark and Sweden, with some 11 outbreaks of violent hostilities since 1521. I don't think there's consensus among historians as to whether this merits a rather questionable world record. But suffice to say that relations have not always been good. Nowadays, the rivalry gets most heated in football where, and this is the only time I'll rely directly on Wikipedia in this podcast, as of 2016, the two nations have played 105 matches with 46 wins for Sweden, 40 for Denmark, and 19 ties. But then again, in 1992, Denmark won the European Championship in Sweden. The history of bad blood between Denmark and Sweden can hardly be explained through the idea of a clash of civilizations. The two countries are not only neighbors. Danish and Swedish languages also resemble each other, and after the Reformation, both countries combined Lutheranism and had periods of absolutism. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that Danish law also built on the principle of religious unity, which we saw in the Swedish instrument of government, although the Danish model of absolute monarchy was unrivaled anywhere after 1660. The King's Law from 1665 makes it pretty clear that it is the duty of the king to protect the realm against heretics, schismatics, and blasphemers. Also,
the absolute monarch of Denmark and Norway shall by all subjects be held and regarded as the greatest and highest head here on earth above all laws of men, and shall know no other head or judges above him either in ecclesiastical or secular affairs except God alone.
In other words, the king was the supreme and undivided head of both church and state. The Danish law from 1683 included detailed provisions requiring strict pre-publication censorship of all writings and strict punishment of seditious and irreligious content. Back then, no one would confuse the Danish and the Dutch when it came to censorship. In the 18th century, the strictness of Orthodox Lutheranism relaxed somewhat due to the double whammy of Pietist influences at court and the influence, or infection, depending on your outlook, of Enlightenment ideals. Pietism was not simply a tolerationist branch of Lutheranism. Imported from Germany, Pietism came in two variants. One was radical Pietism, skeptical of churches, which was the more tolerant strand. Another was state Pietism, developing inside the Lutheran state churches, which inherited the Lutheran idea of unity of faith and the marriage of state and church. Danish state Pietist influences closed theaters and strengthened moral censorship. But just as Jansenist influences created a wider sphere of religious discussion in France during the regency of the Duke of Orléans, so the Pietist influences created cracks in the armor of Danish Lutheran orthodoxy, which even more heterodox ideas could exploit. So much so that in the late 1740s, the French writer La Beaumel, who spent several years in Denmark and even published a French language newspaper, described how the learned elite at court had been seduced by deism through the gateway drug of French philosophy supplied by the Dutch dark web. The works of Pierre Bayle had been especially potent and gotten learned courtiers hooked on enlightenment. Quite a difference from the depressing picture of primitive, pious, and pliant peasants painted by Molesworth half a century before. Still, as we saw in episode 27, Danish rates of literacy and book consumption were paltry compared to the Dutch Republic and England, and even Sweden. And nothing like a real public sphere was possible under the laws in place, which made sure that no writings aimed at the king, state, religion, or morals were tolerated. And when Beaumel published a work attacking absolute monarchy and defending the right of the people to revolt, he duly lost his royal stipend and was sent packing. I'm sure you can guess his next destination. Yep, the Berlin of Alte Fritz, aka Frederick the Great. But new learning was needed, so in the 1740s to 1750s, the government allowed carefully supervised publications on trade and the establishment of academies of science and learning, in order to pick the brains of experts and shape better and more rationalist policies for the kingdom. The most prominent domestic voice for moderate and well-ordered enlightenment was the Danish-Norwegian playwright Ludvig Holberg, author of several well-known plays, novels, and treatises. Holberg had taken a liking to the natural rights ideas of Pufendorf, Grotius, and more controversially, to Pierre Bayle. He advanced the idea that virtue depended on one's character and actions, not on rigid conformity to orthodox religious beliefs. Consequently, Holberg wrote, he would rather make friends with a morally upstanding Jew, heathen, or Mohammedan than with a Christian with no other virtue than that of being named a Christian. Holberg also opposed censorship, since diverse opinions either enlightened the world and countered ignorance, or if wrong-headed, encourage people to investigate matters that they wouldn't have thought about otherwise. To refuse people the freedom to express their thoughts is to prevent the further investigation of truth. Such refusal aided and abetted falsehood, lies, and superstition. Still, Holberg thought censorship useful to weed out opinions by those insufficiently learned and experienced to contribute to the public sphere with substance. He would have been right at home among the enlightened elite in Prussia's Wednesday Club, as we explored in the last episode. Despite these pockets of enlightenment, a prominent contemporary Norwegian academic could write that in Denmark, more than anywhere else, the pens and mouths of the people are held in check. If the control of information and ideas was tightly regulated in Denmark proper, slaves on the West Indian Islands, a Danish colony at the time, were subject to outright barbarism. The so-called slave regulation held that a Negro who subjects a white to rough words shall without mercy be three times pinched and thereafter hanged. Now, pinching was not what you do to your older siblings when you're fighting dirty. It meant red-hot pliers. In other words, if you were a black slave and talked back to a white, you'd be tortured and executed. But there was one place in the kingdom of Denmark-Norway where the winds of intolerance were milder. The city of Altona in the Duchy of Holstein, contemporary Germany, was then under Danish rule. In order to compete with nearby Hamburg, Altona had been granted the privilege of religious tolerance, and the city housed Lutherans, Calvinists, Catholics, Mennonites, and Jews. It also became a haven for radicals, including Johann Lohan Schmidt, who had translated Spinoza's Ethics in 1742. Think of Altona as Denmark's equivalent to 17th century Rhode Island, known then as Rogue Island. One of the radicals who pushed Altona's comparably tolerant climate beyond the breaking point was a young physician named Johann Friedrich Struensee. He would soon become the main protagonist in the Danish history of free speech, although he was not destined for a happy ending. Struensee was attracted to materialist thinking, and historian John Christian Lauesen argues that he was a Spinozist. He certainly pulled no punches in his writings. One article was called Thoughts of a Physician on Superstition and Quackery. He also published his own magazine, Monthly for Use and Pleasure, which included a piece on Diogenes, the ancient Greek cynic who lived in a barrel, masturbated in public, and supposedly told Alexander the Great to get lost because he blocked the sun. Another piece that made the clergy in neighboring Hamburg see red was in the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, who by the very earliest Christians was accused of self-indulgent hedonism and godlessness and depravity and gluttony. And after protests from the Hamburg clergy, the article was duly suppressed by Danish censorship. The fourth and final issue of Struensee's magazine was confiscated and burned in Hamburg and banned in Denmark, which may help explain why in 1764 Struensee wrote an article praising free speech and attacking censorship. The clergy of Altona and Hamburg not only moved to have Struensee's work censored, they attacked him as an arch slanderer of religion and whore stallion. Though whether Struensee saw that as a libel or a compliment is probably open to debate, because as we've seen, he clearly did not respect the sanctity of religious dogma, and as everyone in Denmark-Norway was about to find out, he most certainly did not respect the sanctity of marriage either. In 1768, Struensee was appointed personal physician of the Danish King Christian VII. Now, the king clearly needed medical attention, but more in the shape of a shrink than a physician, for the king was mad as a hatter, probably suffering from schizophrenia, which made him deeply unstable and liable to psychosis. This allowed Struensee not only to win the trust of the king, but also to move from the role of physician to de facto ruler of the realm. He even moved into the king's bedroom, so to speak, as he started a scandalous affair with Queen Carolina Matilda. The king knew, but didn't mind as he himself was fond of sowing his royal oats around the whorehouses of Copenhagen. Struensee's reign was short but intense. In about 16 months, he issued some 1,800 decrees, edicts and orders. Many of them were taken straight from the Enlightenment principles for dummies. He abolished torture, improved conditions for prisoners, restricted privileges of the nobles, released prisoners of conscience, and rationalized administration. He also issued a flood of orders resulting in something like an early sexual revolution that included decriminalizing extramarital sex as well as fathering and giving birth to children outside wedlock, ordered the police to stop arbitrary searches of private homes and taverns, a way to keep a check on seedy brothels, and ordering the church to baptize children born outside wedlock on the same terms as legitimate children. But Struensee grew a little too fond of his new power. He started signing decrees and edicts in his own name, which did not exactly warm the population to him. It didn't help him that he didn't bother to learn Danish, you know, the language of the people of the country, which he now ruled without even a hint of legitimacy. This arrogance would come back to haunt him once he pushed through his boldest move. On 4th September 1770, as one of his very first orders of business, an order on press freedom was issued, which was formalized in a legally binding rescript of 14th September 1770. It read,
"We are fully convinced that it is as harmful to the impartial search for truth as it is to the discovery of obsolete errors and prejudices if upright patriots, zealous for the common good and what is genuinely best for their fellow citizens, because they are frightened by reputation, orders or preconceived opinions, are hindered from being free to write according to their insight, conscience and convictions, attacking abuses and uncovering prejudices. And thus, in this regard, after ripe consideration, we have decided to permit in our kingdoms and lands, in general, an unlimited freedom of the press of such a form that from now on, no one shall be required and obliged to submit books and writings that he wants to bring to the press to the previously required censorship and approval."
And with that, Denmark had become the first and only state in the world to abolish any and all restrictions on freedom of the press. Unlike the Swedish Press Freedom Act, the Danish rescript contained no exceptions or buts as to topics that still needed prior censorship or could not be the subject to the pens of the people. The rescript was widely reported in newspapers from Hamburg to London and Paris, and even the Royal Danish American Gazette in Danish West India, where a certain Alexander Hamilton lived at the time. Voltaire wrote a congratulatory long poem praising King Christian VII for having abolished censorship, which is probably why Sweden's Gustav III planned to lobby Voltaire to support his Potemkin Press Freedom Act in 1774. Now it was just for Struensee to sit back and enjoy all the likes and praise that was sure to follow from the pens of grateful Danes liberated from the centuries of oppressive censorship. And true enough, the inhabitants of Denmark-Norway enthusiastically used their new-won freedom to write and comment on current affairs. Around 1,000 pamphlets were published from 1770 to 1772. You can still read most of them, as they were compiled by a civil servant, running to 46 volumes available at the Royal Danish Library here in Copenhagen. You can find fascinating discussions on economy and trade, on politics and philosophy, and on morality and sex, as well as evergreen discussions on whether press freedom was a blessing or a curse. Many of these debates saw writers responding to each other and developing their arguments, though as always, when the proud and sensitive species of Homo sapiens is involved, many debates also degenerated into name-calling and insults. But despite being given an unprecedented freedom to write, many Danes expressed contempt and ridicule rather than gratitude and praise for the man behind the throne. It turned out that few Danes shared the more radical and hedonistic Enlightenment ideals that this German usurper and adulterer tried to ram down the throats of ordinary God-fearing Danes. Several pamphlets attacked the irreligious ideas of Spinoza and Le Maistre, an indirect way of attacking the materialist views of Struensee. Other pamphlets, most of them anonymous and some of them using allegories,
charged Struensee with treason and of being a scheming foreigner abusing his usurped power to enrich himself at the expense of the country. But most of the critical pamphlets from the more ordinary Danes took issue with Struensee's licentious and immoral lifestyle and values. Betting the queen and wife of the king was bad enough, but turning Copenhagen into Sodom and Gomorrah by repealing the strict moral laws aimed at protecting the sanctity of marriage from the evil of adultery and fornication was adding serious insult to injury. Struensee was clearly shocked at the level of hostility Danish riders shot in his direction with their paper bullets. Sensing his already precarious position being undermined, he issued a new rescript of 7th October 1771 to shield his regime from the worst excesses. It stated that even though all censorship had been abolished and would remain so, there were in fact limits of what could be written. All libels, lampoons, and rebellious publications were subject to punishments, which referred back to the harsh provisions in the Danish law of 1683, which had not been repealed. To counter the many anonymous pamphlets, the rescript also held all authors responsible for unlawful publications. Books had to name the responsible author, or, if the author was unknown, the printer was to be personally responsible for the content. Alas for Struensee, there was no saving him from his increasing unpopularity among Copenhagen elites and masses alike. And the very public PR disaster he had brought on himself played into the hands of his many enemies at court, who did not appreciate this usurper nor his reforms, which undermined both religion, monarchy, and privileges of the elite. In January 1772, at a masquerade ball, a number of aristocrats, theologians, and military officers staged a coup. Struensee was arrested and charged with high treason and lèse majesté. He was only convicted for the latter crime due to his affair with the queen, which had violated the king's person and honor. On 28th April 1772, Struensee mounted the scaffold around 2 kilometers from where I'm sitting right now, and just about at the location of the Danish National Football Stadium. Struensee's right hand was chopped off, then he was beheaded, and his body drawn and quartered, with the severed head and dismembered body parts exhibited publicly. A pretty demonstrable repudiation of Enlightenment principles. Beccaria would not have approved. If Struensee's life fascinates you, you can watch the Danish film A Royal Affair, starring Danish Hollywood actor Mads Mikkelsen as Struensee. It's pretty good and was nominated for both a Golden Globe and an Oscar. The backlash against Struensee and his reforms was swift. While the new regime severely limited press freedom, it also used the public sphere for propaganda purposes, with pamphlets attacking Struensee, while priests were ordered to praise God for having intervened and ensured the downfall of the irreligious and atheistic Struensee in their sermons. The few authors who supported Struensee or uttered criticism of absolutism were punished. A couple of early court cases from 1772 made it clear that in severe cases of books and pamphlets, special courts would be nominated. The theologian Christian Thure was imprisoned for life for his attack on the king for deviating from religion. In October 1773, a new rescript was issued, which railed against the wicked intentions and ignorance of many newspaper writers. It prohibited writings on matters of state, the monarch, politics, attacks on persons, and rumors. These prohibitions were to be administratively enforced by the chief of police, with no due process and severe fines which could be converted into prison if unpaid. But it is worth noting that the new regime did not take the step of formally reintroducing pre-publication censorship. So while Struensee's free speech period was short and the end nasty and brutish, a crucial aspect of his Enlightenment ideals limped on despite the reactionary regime change. In 1784, a new and bloodless coup d'etat brought the young Crown Prince Frederick, later Frederick VI, to power, along with civil servants much more positive towards press freedom than the reactionaries who had removed Struensee. This ushered in a new and much less restrictive era described by the Norwegian historian Øystein Rian as a period of Danish perestroika, which included rigorous debate about the merits of free speech as such. But as I hope we shall have time to explore in a bit more detail later, the combination of the French Revolution and increasingly daring writings by Danish authors caused Crown Prince Frederick to reverse his course. The closing of the Danish public sphere culminated with the harsh Press Freedom Act of 1799, which sent a number of prominent Danish authors into exile and ushered in what is known as the Quiet Period. When Norway broke free from Danish rule in 1814, its Eidsvoll Constitution guaranteed that
an entire liberty of the press shall take place. It is allowed everybody freely to deliver his opinions of government or on any other subject.
But writers who had willingly or evidently shown disobedience or animated others to disobedience against the law, contempt against religion, morality, or the constitutive powers to resistance against orders, or unfettered false and injurious accusations against anybody, could still be punished. A significant clawback, but still much more progressive than the Danish Press Freedom Act of 1799, which remained in force until 1849, when the adoption of the Danish Constitution abolished both all forms of pre-publication censorship and absolute monarchy. Norwegian independence was short-lived as Sweden moved in, but the Eidsvoll Constitution remained in force even after Norway finally became fully independent in 1905 and still serves as the basis of Norway's legal and political system. Getting to Denmark, or rather Scandinavia, would mean a much freer environment for freedom of expression in most countries around the world. In Reporters Without Borders 2019 Global Press Freedom Index, Norway, Sweden and Denmark rank first, third and fifth respectively, with their Nordic cousin Finland squeezing in as second. But there was nothing natural, automatic or straightforward about this happy development, as Struensee and Cudenius would surely testify if they were still with us today. Scandinavia's turnaround from the despotic bogeymen of Molesworth and Tom Paine to international beacons of freedom of expression and open government should serve as an inspiration as to what can be achieved for people living under censorship and repression, but also as a cautionary tale of how freedom of expression can never be taken for granted. Behind every corner of progress turned lies reaction in wait to snuff out the free and open exchange of ideas that challenge power and authority. Thank you so much for listening to yet another episode. In fact, this was the 30th. As always, please like and share on social media and give us a review on iTunes.